So to start the tape here.
This is Interview with Conrad Dannenberg, tape one, side two. And I can remember where we were when we interrupted.
Well, I think we talked about injection systems, about the V2 engine, and you just asked, that was in existence when I got to Peenemünde.
Right.
So I did not participate in the basic design of the rocket engine.
Of the 25-ton
right.
A4 motor. So that the first ones were built after you got there, probably. Is that right, as you recall?
Or maybe at about the time when I got there.
Mm-hmm.
It takes some time to build these things. They are relatively complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And they were in the shop already. The fuel injection nozzles could be exchanged.
Mm-hmm.
And all the early combustion chambers had all the nozzles exchangeable.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, as I mentioned earlier, we found ways and means that some of them are just straight holes through the ball.
Mm-hmm.
But in the beginning, all the nozzles, all the four rows were exchangeable. So you could make changes after you had built the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you put the proper nozzles in, and of course also the fuel, the LOX injectors could mm-hmm. also be exchanged.
Mm-hmm. So that you might use the same basic, assuming you didn't have a burn through or some other kind of accident, you could use the same combustion chamber repeatedly
right.
by changing the injectors
right.
over and over again, repeatedly on tests.
And of course, and if we had burn throughs, as I said, really as an afterthought, we introduced this extra internal cooling.
Mm-hmm.
Just injecting some fuel, assuming it wouldn't burn, and then of course it has a film layer of unburned fuel which cools your ball.
Mm-hmm.
Now apparently every once in a while one of the LOX injection streams, injection jets, still got through the whole combustion chamber and hit the wall.
Mm-hmm.
So every once in a while we still had, even after this introduction, a burn through.
Mm-hmm. What did you do about that problem?
Well, either introduce a little bit more fuel, cool it a little bit more, which of course costs performance, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be very careful how far you can go.
The more.
And also, of course, you had to be sure that this just didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the early production, where we didn't have real production tools, where all these holes were drilled by hand, so to speak, you could every once in a while have a chance that one hole was drilled on the wrong angle, and that in that case the fuel really got all the way to the wall of the chamber. And apparently mm-hmm. once that happened, you had a burn through at that place.
Where you had an excess oxygen concentration
yeah. mm-hmm.
along the wall. That's where
yeah.
that's where you tended to mm-hmm. get the burn throughs. So the idea of, I guess it's been called film cooling.
Right.
Came up after you got there?
Right. As far as I know, it came up fairly late.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to claim it was my invention, but with this whole team of universities and other people working on it, we finally introduced this as a necessity.
Mm-hmm. Was it introduced on... So you introduced that idea first on the smaller motors, do you remember?
No, I don't really recall. We may have had it on the 1.4-tonner. We definitely did not have it on the 1-tonner.
Mm-hmm.
The 1.4-tonner may have had it, and likely the 4.2-tonner
mm-hmm.
had probably one of these extra injection rings.
Mm-hmm.
Because we normally tried these things first on the smaller engines. You can build them faster, and if you lose them, the loss mm-hmm. is not quite as great as losing one of these here.
Right. So at the beginning, what you did was you drilled a series of holes along the inside of the combustion chamber above the throat.
Right.
And
of course, we need an extra high-pressure chamber, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So we had to go through the cooling jacket. And for cooling, of course, you had to have some holes drilled this way. And then the other small holes for the film cooling, as you called it, which mm-hmm. is a proper term, you had small holes drilled in this direction.
Mm-hmm.
And of course you had to watch that the holes didn't interfere with each other.
Mm-hmm.
If that happened, you were also in trouble.
Okay, I'm not quite sure what you mean by the other holes on the outside. I know that at 6 points around the bottom of the nozzle,
right.
You have the injection of the fuel into the cooling jacket.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Not into the cooling jacket.
Mm-hmm.
The cooling jacket has to let the fuel go through in this direction.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you need one set of holes in this direction.
Mm-hmm.
To cool the inside of the auger chamber, you had to have holes in this direction.
Mm-hmm.
Small holes. That was a relatively small amount.
Mm-hmm.
Only a very small percentage.
Okay, so but these are drilled from the inside of the engine into the cooling jacket? I mean, is
no, not the cooling jacket. Mm-hmm. That's why we had these manifolds on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
They were little ridges on the outside, and they have a higher pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not necessarily a higher pressure, but they are independent of the cooling jacket.
Mm-hmm. So that the film cooling is not leaking fuel out of the cooling jacket then?
It does not get the fuel out of the cooling jacket. It was mm-hmm. an extra supply, and that's why you had this welded manifold going all the way around.
Okay, so that...
And from that manifold area, you had to drill your holes this way to get the mm-hmm. fuel to the inside of the chamber.
From the driller holes from the inside?
No, they were really drilled from the outside, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
It would be awfully tough to go inside with a drill in your chamber, although you could get into the chamber.
Mm-hmm.
The A4 chamber was relatively large. You could easily, and I was thinner in those mm-hmm. days, I could easily get with my whole head in this area here,
mm-hmm.
and we could inspect the nozzles.
But, okay, so they would be drilled from the outside.
From the outside, all the way through.
Before the external wall was put on.
Well, that was all really just one manufacturing process.
Mm-hmm.
So you took one ring,
mm-hmm.
and you drilled your holes through that ring in this way for film cooling.
Mm-hmm.
But you also needed holes going through in this direction so that the cooling flow did not get interrupted.
Mm-hmm.
And of course you welded the internal cooling jacket, the internal piece of metal which formed the cooling jacket, and the outside piece of metal. You welded it also to the thing. Maybe we should make a little sketch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm finding it. I have to give you a better piece of paper if you want here on the bottom of this name sheet that I have from here's the base.
Let me draw one side of the cooling jacket. In order to permit the flow, and this here is an internal wall, and there was an outside wall. And let me show that just with one line. Although, of course, it also had a specific thickness. Well, now I have two lines after all. And in order to permit the inside cooling, we had to cut the combustion chamber open, and we had to weld a piece of metal in there. So this here are the welding seams now, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And we had to weld a piece of metal in there that had on the one side holes drilled through here, so mm-hmm. that the fuel could pass through that welded piece. And then we also had to drill small holes here in this direction. And then there was another welded chamber, so to speak, which was supplied with fuel. And I don't recall right now where was the pressure really higher. We could influence the amount of flow that went through these film cooling holes by putting at the part where you have your line, by putting the blender, we called it, a little orifice in, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
An orifice which had a relatively small hole in the orifice. And by changing the hole, you could influence the flow, the amount of fuel that went to the inside.
Mm-hmm. You called it a blender?
Blender.
Okay.
Of course, the German word for it, yeah?
Is this... outside wall here?
This here is a combustion chamber.
Okay.
Here you have the combustion going on. And of course this wall here was relatively thick.
The inside wall?
For weight reasons this wall was a little bit thinner, Because this wall has not only to take the pressure, but also the temperature.
Mm-hmm.
So that gets hot, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And steel has less rigidity once it's hot. So this wall can, for that reason, be somewhat thinner.
Mm-hmm.
It's still relatively thick and relatively heavy. And, no, I forgot what I wanted to say.
You were talking about how the cooling flow, the problem of you have a cooling flow on the one hand and then you have the injection of the film cooling.
Right.
On the
and
other.
You could influence the amount of film cooling you got by putting these little orifices here in the supply line.
Mm-hmm.
So this here was in the supply line.
Mm-hmm.
And that was another thing we basically did by experimentation.
Okay.
So we really didn't make too many high-level calculations. Of
mm-hmm.
course, you could calculate the amount of flow you get through there, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
But it was really an experimental process to use smaller and smaller orifices
mm-hmm.
in order to bring up the performance.
Start the tape again. Okay, this, so this film cooling, you had like these ridges around the outside. The 25-ton motor, was that where the alcohol circulated for the
not
for
necessarily
the film cooling?
Not necessarily all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them also had the purpose, and about half of them, I would say roughly, had the purpose. This relatively thick wall on the inside becomes hot, and it has an average temperature of around 1,000 Fahrenheit. And that, of course, means it expands. It
mm-hmm.
becomes longer. And when the engine is burning, it's about half an inch longer than if it's cool, if it's not burning.
Mm-hmm.
In order to take care of that expansion, we also, at some places, had to interrupt the outer shell. And we did it on the outside only, not on the inside. So there was a gap here. And then we also had to, in order to close a gap, to weld another thing, which looks almost like this one here,
mm-hmm.
to it. And due to its structural flexibility, it permitted you to take certain mm-hmm. small amounts of expansion, yeah?
Right.
And since you couldn't handle the entire expansion with just one of these, we had several of those.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember anymore how many. You probably would have to go out to the engine and look at it. But some of them were just expansion joints, expansion folds,
mm-hmm.
and some others injected the fuel to the inside.
Mm-hmm. Where you had injection of fuel, was that accommodated into the expansion joint? Or were they two separate?
That were two separate things. That's
mm-hmm.
why we have so many of them, yeah? And as
mm-hmm.
I said, they are not all for film cooling injection.
Mm-hmm.
Only roughly about half of them.
On this picture in Reisig's article, page 46, you see this small tube that going down the side of the engine. Is that for the separate alcohol supply for film cooling, or is that something else altogether?
That is one of the lines for the film cooling.
Mm-hmm.
In order to supply these extra lines here, yeah, we had a line going all the way down to the lower one. It doesn't go all the way down.
Mm-hmm.
It goes down to about here, and maybe there's even some film cooling injection for the lower uncooled part to keep that from burning through, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And these lines supply these film cooling supply manifolds.
Mm-hmm. So that you had a separate piping system.
Right.
Film cooling.
Right.
Went back up to the fuel line
mm-hmm.
above the engine.
And I just see they are connected up here.
Mm-hmm.
And since up here your pressure is, of course, already a little bit lower than down here, the pressure in these cooling supply lines was lower than the pressure in the cooling jacket, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't want to tap directly into the cooling jacket, what you probably could have done, but you had two disadvantages. Firstly, you normally filled your chamber before you started your test, and your
mm-hmm.
fuel would have seeped out, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Your fuel would not have stayed in the jacket. That's
mm-hmm.
why you needed these, so you could close them, yeah? So that you had no fuel loss. And also, by doing it this way, the more complicated way, you could control the amount of flow.
Mm-hmm.
If otherwise you have direct holes, you have no control over the flow anymore.
Right.
The flow is then completely determined by the size of your holes.
So this way you could experiment with different amounts of...
Right, right. And what we normally try to do is to reduce it. So that was one of the purposes of the early development tests, to use as little film cooling as possible without getting burn throughs.
The fuel, I mean, what's the disadvantage there? It's, you're losing alcohol without burning it.
Right. And you lose ISP. You lose efficiency.
Do you reduce the exhaust velocity a little bit by injecting this?
Right. You have a lower exhaust velocity. You have a lower ISP in there with a lower exhaust velocity. And the exhaust velocity, of course, determines your thrust, so you don't get all the thrust you would like to have.
Okay, so this was sort of forced by the cooling problem
right.
on you, that you, in order to prevent the burn-throughs
right.
on the nozzle.
And of course, a burn-through is catastrophic, yeah? Once you have a burn-through, you have had it. If you lose a little bit in efficiency, maybe you cannot quite make your range. But there were many short-range firings, and for those, you could still use your engine. So it's not catastrophic.
This gets out of the chronological order, but was that limited to essentially to the A4 generation of motors that you worked on, the film cooling? Did you get rid of that?
We don't have it today anymore, but today you probably know we have these very thin, fine cooling tubes. They cool much better. They don't have the problem of expansion because they stay relatively cool. They have normally more or less the temperature of the coolant. And that's also why we can fire now the Space Shuttle main engine up to 50 times, NASA hopes eventually to do it. With these engines, you couldn't do it. Due to all these problems, they have wore out pretty quick. And I would say normally you could make 3-4 tests, but after that the engine was no good anymore.
The expansion and contraction of the nozzle create metal strain, metal fatigue, and so forth. So, did you use the gum cooling in Redstone?
Well, you asked me that too much. I would have to look at the engine. It is possible that we still used it, but a better mixing nozzle where you don't have too much concentration of LOX at one place might solve the problem. So, I think that was to a high degree the problem with the V2 engine.
I guess another problem, which there's nothing that can be done about it in the short run, is development of exotic materials.
Well, of course,
you
in Peenemünde,
that steel, basically.
In Peenemünde, there was no chance at all, and that takes a long time, and so we had to depend even on relatively low quality steel. It was not stainless like people use normally today for rocket engines.
So you had to, of course, you, with material shortages, you had to make sure you made an engine that could be
mass-produced,
given the materials that you could get from the war economy. Okay, so that you were testing this 18-head injecting motor from, oh, say, 41, and got reasonable performance out of it by when? Do you have any... any recollection?
Well, we were still working on improvements when the engine was being used already, so I would say later V2s had a somewhat better performance than the early ones. Because, again, we had a lot of flexibility to change the film cooling flow that improves the performance, to change the injection system. And I think almost to the last moment where you finally went into mass production. Once we were in mass production, there were no changes of that type anymore. Then the people took it. And I would say the mass production was finally ordered in late 43. And so from then on, you couldn't make changes of this nature just to improve the performance. We still had many changes, and some people even complained we had too many. When you had a real critical condition,
And I did you also have the problem that... materials or would suddenly disappear.
Right,
so
you couldn't get it anymore.
You'd have to, you have to make the part a different way.
We were short in aluminum, so we were working on fuel tanks, basically made from paperboard. Well, paperboard a little bit more like the milk cartons we use today. So a relatively solid, saturated paper with wax in it or something like that, pretty much like the milk cartons we use today.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the main reason was we just couldn't get enough aluminum.
Mm-hmm.
We did need aluminum for the LOX tank, so there was no plan to replace that.
Mm-hmm.
But we were seriously working on replacing the fuel tank. Now, I think it was never done. We mm-hmm. just did some research and development tests.
The LOX tank had to be aluminum for a reason of
interaction. Brittleness reasons. Still, a steel mm-hmm. becomes so brittle, it mm-hmm. just cannot stand the vibrations during burning mm-hmm. and contain the very cold liquid oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to go to aluminum for that. And that's why we also have a separate, you probably know, the V2 has a separate outer shell. That has to be from steel because it gets awfully hot during re-entry.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't use aluminum there. But the fuel tank, the LOX tank, had to be aluminum because otherwise with our existing steels, we didn't have any steel that would take these very cold temperatures.
Mm-hmm. And the fuel tank, the alcohol tank?
Well, that was initially built also from aluminum. And when aluminum supply became short, then we were asked to work on alternate mm-hmm. methods.
But the steel
and steel was also relatively short, yeah? So mm-hmm. steel was kind of ruled out also. We could have used steel. That would not, mm-hmm. not have been too difficult.
Mm-hmm. You could have built a steel fuel yeah. tank, but that had mm-hmm. it, early on you had determined to mm-hmm. build these things in aluminum.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before I get to these other injector versions, I've forgotten what my question was now. Well, let me ask you about the injector. So you mentioned before, of course, that you worked on the other injectors, alternative engine to replace this system, which was kind of complicated to mm-hmm. make, the difficult problem to make. So, and I've seen in these documents a number of references. There are two main ones. There's one called a Ringspalt Mischdüse, which was something that some guy in Berlin, at Beck, I think.
Beck, maybe, yeah. He was a professor, the leading professor in Berlin.
And the other one was called a Bohrungsmischdüse. And in the one report from Lindenberg, he mentions you and him as the main workers on this other concept. So can you describe those different injectors?
Well, the Spaltmischdüse is just a different kind of injection. You use you know what a spalt is, I guess, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
A ring slot, a very thin ring slot that goes mm-hmm. all the way around. And you save the work of drilling.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, you need very highly accurate manufacturing methods. Mm-hmm. Your ring slot should have the same dimension all the way around, and that's one of the problems.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's also much more difficult to change it. If you find out you don't have the right ring slot, you practically have to throw all your hardware away and start from scratch again.
Mm-hmm.
If you just drill all your fuel and LOX injection holes, you can start with a relatively small hole, you find out that's not big enough, and you can increase it, you can make it a little bit bigger.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a little bit more flexibility. And also for the Bohrungsdüsen, we tried in many cases to oppose the jets to each other, either fuel against fuel,
mm-hmm.
or also, and that's one thing that Lindenberg proposed quite a bit, to use one fuel and one LOX jet. And mm-hmm. to let them impinge and atomize by impingement.
Mm-hmm.
So I think most of the people believed that the Bohrungsmischdüse would be more flexible, would be simpler, could be... the other one probably has the advantage it can be easier manufactured. When you mm-hmm. once you know how to do it, it's probably easier instead of the many, many little holes. You have to drill with very great accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, like with a cooling system, you don't have only holes going through this way in order to inject your fuel. To supply your fuel, you also have to drill holes this way.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you have to be darn sure that these holes don't meet each other. So you have really quite an accuracy problem.
Mm-hmm. Now, from this document here, from this archive report from Lindenberg, in which you were mentioned, it seems like he is complaining somewhat about what he sees as the inadequacy of Beck's system compared to...
Let me turn the lights on.
Okay. So I should have... To make this on tape, we're talking about this archive report 3914, which is Lindenberg's almost a complaint in August 1943, actually just before the air raid, a week or so before the first air raid. But you were working on, there was the Ringspalt Mischdusa, I think we said a little bit before on tape, but that was a single gap. A single...
No, there were a few gaps, but relatively few gaps compared with a large number of holes you would have to drill.
Mm-hmm.
So it really should have led to a drastic reduction in manufacturing time. And that was the main purpose, of course. And also many people felt even we never would be able to produce this very complicated 18-ton unit.
Mm-hmm.
But, and maybe you made the point that this happened just before the bomb raid on Peenemünde.
Mm-hmm.
Due to the bomb raid, of course, we had so many other new problems that finally all these improvements could not be introduced. So they never got into real existence for a production vehicle. We did quite a number of tests, as he pointed out, yeah? But they never were used in the actual production series. So they were all built with these 18 elements. And after the people had learned how to weld them, we really didn't have all that many difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
I was always amazed by that. You see, it's a very complicated design. And if you have to weld all these things together, it requires quite a bit of skill.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we didn't have too many skilled workers, but they somehow apparently managed. And to my knowledge, we never had any real big basic difficulties with the welding design as such.
Mm-hmm.
But still, in order, it requires a lot of work, a lot of labor, special equipment, special tools, and in order to simplify it, there was quite a drive on for quite some time, apparently up to the time of the bomb raid, in order to simplify the combustion chamber. That was really one of the major efforts going on parallel to the actual production design. And there were these two competing mixing nozzle designs. And Lindenberg even mentions another design, which I hadn't thought about for quite some time, to not use only one big mixing nozzle, which of course has problems with drilling these long holes with great accuracy. Yeah, so you might be better off with using smaller units, where your holes are much shorter.
Mm-hmm.
You can really go in mass production. You build six times as many. So you can really build good manufacturing equipment for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently that also had quite some difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see the difficulties in the vortex zones between these six injection nozzles, yeah? While a regular nozzle, which covers a whole area, injects fuel at all the places.
Mm-hmm.
Here you have some vortex zones where no fuel is being injected, and you might get burn throughs at those places.
So,
so that design apparently was pretty soon dropped. In fact, for that reason, I probably hadn't even thought about it anymore, but I remember we worked on such a design. And really, in spite of that memo there from Lindenberg, the main effort was really to use a Bohrungsmischdüse.
Mm-hmm.
And also the later introduction in the Redstone is basically the Bohrungsmischdüse.
Right. That you have that basic, what is now pretty much a standard injector plate.
Right.
With the holes across the plate.
And the funny thing is Riedel, who went to NAA and who finally built and designed the Redstone engine, he worked with Beck, so he really should have been more in favor of the Spaltmischdüse. But maybe after all the tests which had been done, he also concluded that the Spaltmischdüse has its own problems.
Mm-hmm. Now this Riedel is Riedel 3.
Riedel 3,
that
right.
You're talking about.
Yeah.
The second, the Walter Riedel who came later, not the one Papa,
right.
who was there for so many years. Okay, so as far as you remember, this Professor Beck's Ringspalt Mischdusa was tested in 41, 42, 43, somewhere in there.
Must have been that time, because they had already some tests here in 43, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And they probably were still continuing to do tests in 43. On the other hand, as I said, after the bomb raid, of course, many of these advanced ideas had to be dropped.
Mm-hmm.
We had to concentrate on getting the drawings out, getting the V2s really into mass production. And as I said earlier already, there was a point where we, where all the designers were being told, no changes anymore for mere improvement. Mm-hmm. Changes which have to be done, where you know something doesn't work, they can still be accomplished. But no changes in order just to improve the performance a little bit. So they mm-hmm. were all ruled out, and that was probably in a way in mm-hmm. that category.
Okay. As far as you remember then, that your other concept of having this, what they was called at that time, the Bohrungsmischdüse, mm-hmm. this injector plate with bored holes
mm-hmm.
in it, that was actually the favorite concept for a second generation
right.
A4 motor.
Mm-hmm.
What problems did you have with it when you put it on the test stand?
Well, particularly the combustion vibration problems I mentioned mm-hmm. earlier. Very heavy vibrations that sometimes even destroyed the whole combustion chamber. And we never got completely over it. Finally, for the Redstone injection nozzle, apparently the problem was solved. I am not aware of major problems in that area.
Mm-hmm.
But in Peenemünde, we just couldn't solve it.
What is the cause of that vibration? I gather from the Reisig article that the injector plate would actually flex in and out due to fluctuations in chamber
pressure. Well, of course, but that's only the result of the vibrations. Yeah, mm-hmm. Once you have the vibrations, that probably is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
The question is still, why do we have the vibrations? We found out from other similar tests, once you increase your injection pressure drop, of course you mm-hmm. lose some pressure when you inject your fuel, yeah? And once you have a higher value, a larger pressure loss, so to speak, you are better off. The vibrations mm-hmm. are not quite as tough. On the other hand, of course, it makes it tough on your pump. Your pump has to generate more pressure in order to get your fuel through the relatively mm-hmm. small holes.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's even what finally was done for the Redstone nozzle, that they went to fairly large pressure drops. I don't recall right offhand what the pressure drop is there, and that may have solved the problem.
Mm-hmm. So you have a problem then of the capacity of your turbo pump.
Right.
To turbo pumps mm-hmm. to push out mm-hmm. fuel and oxidizer mm-hmm. at a certain rate.
Yeah, not so much the rate, but the pressure.
Mm-hmm. Pressure.
It has to generate more mm-hmm. pressure in order to get the same amount of flow through smaller holes, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, again, if it solves your problem, if it saves your problem, mm-hmm. if it's the answer to your problem, you probably are willing to do it.
Was the answer partly in the long run to go to smaller holes, injector holes?
Well, that's what I recall. That was one of the ways of getting rid at least of a part, of a portion mm-hmm. of these heavy vibrations.
Mm-hmm. Because I think there's a mention in this article, perhaps, of that the noise created by those engine tests was so loud that it was heard all over.
Right, it was screaming, as the people normally refer to it.
Mm-hmm. That was all due to the vibrations.
Right.
In the vibrations are created by fluctuations in the chamber pressure.
And you have less vibrations if you have a stronger pressure drop.
Mm-hmm.
If your pressure drop is only very small, then these vibrations can easily even go back into your injection holes, yeah, into mm-hmm. your injection flow. And that's at least my interpretation why it works better at higher pressure drop levels.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, for Wasserfall, what injector did you use? Did you use a modification of that injector?
As far as I know, they went finally to a Mischdüse.
Mm-hmm. So you did perfect a smaller version of
right,
that.
Right. On the other hand, of course, the Wasserfall was never mass-produced.
Mm-hmm.
They flew a few test vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure they still have some problems. I was not too close to the Wasserfall, so I don't know the details there too well.
Mm-hmm. So you were not directly involved in the propulsion plant development for Wasserfall?
For Wasserfall, no, I was not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was at that time in charge of getting the V2 really being mass-produced. I was Riedel's deputy, Walter Riedel's deputy,
mm-hmm.
and he, as head of research and development was in charge to get the drawings out, to get the drawings to the Mittelwerke for production. And that was really my main effort in the last 1 or 2 years, to get all the drawings established,
mm-hmm.
to stop changes. We had a fairly tight change procedure, so the people had to propose to the change board what they wanted to change, and if the change board turned it down, the change was not being made. On the other hand, as you pointed out, there were many changes that had to be made. We didn't get the material anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That is one of the reasons that we finally drilled the holes in these injection elements. We mm-hmm. couldn't get enough brass. These nozzles were built from brass.
Mm-hmm.
And we just couldn't get enough. So we finally went to the method just to drill the holes in the ball, which is, of course, also simpler, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So you also save labor.
Mm-hmm. How would you have done it with brass? Could you cast the brass?
They were basically cast, and they had to be turned on a lathe, and then they were screwed into the ball.
Mm-hmm.
So the ball had to have, instead of a round hole, a thread in it,
mm-hmm.
a thread for these little individual nozzles.
Mm-hmm. The injectors, you mean, each... Okay, but you had originally tried to cast them in bronze,
right?
With the holes.
All the early designs were for all the nozzles bronze nozzles.
They were cast with the holes already without having to bore.
No,
them.
No, you still had to drill the hole,
mm-hmm.
and you also had to turn them. They had to be fairly accurate. You couldn't in those days cast a thread.
Mm-hmm.
They had to have a thread in order to be threaded in. So mm-hmm. that involves a lot of lathe labor.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so at what point did you, in 43, did you really start working on the mass production of the 18 injector engine? Was that before the air raid sometime that you were transferred to that duty?
That was pretty much parallel to the air raid. That was about the time when it had been decided to mass produce the V2s.
Mm-hmm.
And von Braun objected to it initially, as you may have heard from other people. He thought the V2 was really not quite developed. We should have another year or so of extra development time.
Mm-hmm.
But he was overruled, and the Army and the SS at that time also, who already was in the process of taking over Peenemünde, they decided, regardless of all the problems, we are going ahead and we are going to mass produce them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I was put in charge to really get all the drawings out, to get them delivered to the Mittelwerke,
mm-hmm.
so that the people there could write their orders. They still, the parts had to be ordered. They had not been manufactured. To deliver the parts, to finally assemble all these things, and finally get the complete V2s out.
Mm-hmm. So as far as this was, as far as this mass production task was concerned, I know that the Speer started to press very hard for mass production right at the beginning of 43.
Mm-hmm.
This is after Hitler had signed an order for that. And so then the Sonderausschuss A4 came into the picture in the spring of 43,
mm-hmm.
with Degenkolb and Sauer and Savatsky, mm-hmm. and those people
yeah.
came in.
And all these people, of course, kite for drawings, yeah? That's mm-hmm. why I was put in almost as a commissioner
mm-hmm.
to get the drawings together, because, of course, these people could not go to our individual designers and force them. So that was a task of the design office to really say, this is it, this is what we think we should produce.
Mm-hmm.
And that really took most of my time during 43 and 44, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that in sometime about the middle of 42, is the very beginning of this process, Stahlknecht came from Speer's ministry.
Right.
And he was the...
Was he already with Speer? I didn't realize that.
I think he was delegated from Speer's ministry.
Mm-hmm.
That he came in the middle of 42, as I recall, and they set up a... On one organization chart, it's called Nachbaudirektion,
mm-hmm.
Which I gather was an office for trying to get the production drawings.
To get the production going.
Mm-hmm.
And they initially also wanted to do all our drawings over. They wanted to simplify everything and make it easier to be produced.
Mm-hmm.
But that failed. That failed very badly.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, Walter Riedel I got a bad name. because mm-hmm. he was also in the Nachbaudirektion and he was in charge of all these production drawings. But when they then finally built the parts and tested them, they found out most of the parts don't work.
Mm-hmm.
So we finally went really back again to the R&D drawings, to the research and development drawings, not to the production drawings,
mm-hmm.
which had been prepared by a separate group of people. And this separate group of people worked under Walter Riedel.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is important. I hadn't gotten the information on exactly what happened
mm-hmm.
with this whole
Probably thing. Riess would be a real good man to talk to about that kind of thing. He was mm-hmm. involved directly. He was Vermont's deputy, and he was really most in charge of production activities in Peenemünde
mm-hmm.
and also in connection with the Mittelwerke.
Okay. Now, as far as this
and Riess has an awfully sharp memory. He remembers dates and names mm-hmm. and everything.
Yeah, I'm supposed to talk to him tomorrow. I don't know if they realize how many hours this could could be if I were to talk.
Yeah, don't make it too hard on him. Try to make it relatively short.
Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to straighten this out, and I know perhaps I have to ask other people to get mm-hmm. more information. Stahlknecht came in, and they set up this Nachbaudirektion
mm-hmm.
in order to create the production drawings, basically,
right.
in mm-hmm. order to be able to put it
production
in
drawings and also set up the production. So it mm-hmm. was not only the drawings, but the tools you need.
Mm-hmm.
They started to hire the labor force, so they brought all mm-hmm. the extra people in.
Mm-hmm.
And they were really in charge of a complete mass production.
Mm-hmm.
And it was intended to keep Peenemünde a research and development agency.
Mm-hmm. Because I know, of course, on top of that, you also have, you know, what was called the Versuchsserienwerk or the Fertigungsstelle mm-hmm. Peenemünde, that's Arthur Rudolph's production facility mm-hmm. that was going to be at Peenemünde South. Stahlknecht and people were working with Rudolph and so forth in this Versuchsserienwerk, mm-hmm. and then of course they brought in the idea of getting other places like mm-hmm. Zeppelin, Luftschiffbau mm-hmm. Zeppelin working on. So their first task was to set up the production drawings. Walter Riedel I was displaced as sort of chief designer before that time.
It may have happened before that time. He really was in a way replaced when Riedel III came in. These two never got along too well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Riedel III had finally a stronger voice in von Braun's ear.
Mm-hmm.
And so he apparently insisted that Riedel not be the design chief, be the head of the design bureau.
Mm-hmm.
So that was finally given to Riedel, although I personally don't think it has to be done that way. A research and development director can, in my opinion, do without the design office.
Mm-hmm.
But Riedel III... apparently insisted, and so that put Riedel I, who was up to that time in charge of the design office,
mm-hmm.
that put him out of commission. And maybe that's one of the reasons that he finally went to Stahlknecht,
mm-hmm.
and that he then took over the production series.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the fact that people complained about him quite a bit and that they said the production drawings are really not what works,
mm-hmm.
maybe to a large extent due to Riedel III.
Mm-hmm.
He apparently picked up a lot of little incidents and put them all together and made him look, in general, pretty bad.
Walter Riedel I, you made...
Right. Yeah, so, they are both Walter Riedels.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it makes for confusion when you're relating mm-hmm. this. But so you're not entirely sure that Walter Riedel I was done a justice?
Well, he was to a degree treated badly. I think I can say that. He was himself quite a bit disappointed, I know that.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, up to that time he was in charge of all the design work.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that he was only in charge of the production design. And maybe the job, the task they gave him was too big a task. Because
mm-hmm.
you just cannot take these research and development items and put them in mass production type configuration. You are bound to run into problems.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened to a relatively large degree. And so finally, as I said, we finally had to switch back to the R&D drawings, and they were really used for the mass production.
Mm-hmm.
The production people still helped to a certain degree whenever we had to change materials. So there was still a lot of work to be done, and our relatively small design office was not always capable of handling all the many, many things that still had to be changed.
Mm-hmm. Let me just stop.